those candles out, Juan.
Ready? One, two, three.
All right, Juan. Congratulations. Thank you, everyone. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez with 23 years of Democracy Now! Thanks so much for making it happen.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
This is DJ Love Jones, producer of the world-famous Confessional and DJ for Necropolis, starting every Sunday, midnight to 3 a.m. I want to personally invite you to come on out to the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna, host of the world-famous Confessional, will be live on stage reading your secrets and confessions prior to the movie. There'll be prizes. Come on out for a fun evening that benefits your community radio station, KBOO. That's Blazing Saddles, Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.
Good evening. This is KBOO Portland. It's 5:01. KBOO programming is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Trillium Public Charter School in North Portland. Enrollment for the 2019-2020 school year is now open for students K through 12 with an open house on February 21st at 6:30 p.m. More information online at trilliumcharterschool.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Oregon joins 16 other states in a lawsuit against Trump's state of national emergency for a border wall.
Senator Bernie Sanders announces his campaign for president in 2020.
And in international news, Turkish law enforcement has detained more than 300 people with alleged Gulen ties.
Good evening, this is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, February 19th, 2019. I'm Alex Riedlinger.
And I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu. Oregon has joined 16 other states in a lawsuit against President Trump for his attempt to use emergency powers to build a border wall. The lawsuit is filed in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. It alleges that Trump's actions exceed his executive powers and violate the Constitution. It also argues that diversion of Congress-appropriated funds for a border wall would be detrimental to the states and communities that depend on them. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum says that by invoking emergency powers, the Trump administration is, quote, flagrantly skirting the rule of law. She added, quote, to pay for his false emergency, Mr. Trump is willing to take away funding from national security, drug intervention projects, and military upgrades that our states need. The president needs a check and balance on his authority. So once again, we will see him in court. The other states listed as plaintiffs in the suit are California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, and Virginia. The attorney generals from all 16 states hope to block Trump's emergency declaration and prevent the construction of a wall on the southern border.
This morning, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont announced his campaign for the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. In 2016, Senator Sanders was virtually unknown. However, with progressive policies like Medicare for All, free higher education for all, and a $15 an hour minimum wage, he quickly turned the Democratic Party upside down. Now he is considered by many to be the Democratic frontrunner, with a large lead in his donor base and a growing national grassroots organization named Our Revolution. This campaign will be different considering his name recognition, and a change in the political climate has shown his ideas to be popular, with the Democratic Party showing strong support for mainstreaming Democratic socialist legislators and agendas. Unlike 2016, when Sanders was the only primary challenger to Hillary Clinton, Senator Sanders is joining a fairly crowded field. In contention for the Democratic nomination are Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Kamala Harris of California, both considered strong contenders within the progressive wing of the party. Senator Sanders has hired the National Political Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Faiz Shakir, to be his campaign manager. Shakir is considered to be one of the most experienced progressives in the Democratic Party, having been a senior advisor to former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Critics of Senator Sanders have been quick to point out his age. At 77, he is the oldest candidate running, and voters may be looking for a fresher approach. Skeptics have also highlighted his struggles to reach out to and garner support amongst black voters. This year, Sanders has struggled to overcome disclosures about his 2016 campaign's handling of sexual misconduct complaints, with a culture of silence, and women paid less than male colleagues in campaign organizations across the country.
The Pacific Northwest Family Circle held a protest today outside the Multnomah County Courthouse. This is part of a national campaign led by Yolanda McNair of POST, or Protect Our Stolen Treasures, based out of Detroit, Michigan. The organizers of today's event were relatives of those killed by police in the Portland area. Their objective is to hold district attorneys accountable for protecting the community against police violence. Here is some of the audio from today's event.
Our next demand in the Feet to Fire National Campaign for Police Accountability is to create a nationwide database for police officers with a nationwide background check, including a psychological exam on all officers and a waiting period for all out-of-state hires to ensure all reports and reviews from the former state and department have been received and reviewed. So, I am here to tell you that when police officers kill a community member, I've already told you, they're all found justified, at least in Oregon so far, and then if they decide that they want to move on to another office or another town, they are free to do that because, well, they were just doing their job, and no one tracks how many people or who or what situation anyone was killed in. So we have no database. They could just move from anywhere to anywhere. Even if they get fired from their police department for misconduct or something else, that's even unrelated to police violence, to killing community members. They could still move on to another town. There's no database. And of course, you know, I mean, personally, if I'm hiring somebody, I'd like to see a nice, robust resume. How many people did you kill? What was going on when you killed them? Where were you? Where were they? I would want an account of that before I hired anyone that killed somebody. We want to include yearly random tests and checks with certification in shooting and procedures. Four community members in the OIR report were killed because police officers fell. Police officers shot them while they were chasing them, and they fell. Revoke the peace officer license for repeated offenses of excessive force. Right on. 2, repeated use of deadly force as a first defense. Right. 3, questionable behaviors, mental or physical, resulting in disciplinary action. 4, forced retirement or resignation under questionable circumstance involving drugs, sex, and use of a weapon. And we define a weapon as a gun, a taser, a baton, or pepper spray.
I'm here with the mother of Christopher Kalonji. We just heard some of the story of how your son was killed. And again, deepest condolences to you.
Thank you.
And today would have been his birthday?
Yeah, today. He did not make 1 month. He was killed January 28, 2016. And he did not make 1 month to his 20th. And today is February 19. So he would be He could be 23 years old. And it's hard, especially today. And especially it's, you can hear every week police killing someone. And it goes through like your personal pain because you know how families suffer. And it's right when they say they don't kill only your family members, they kill all family.
Tell us a little bit more about your son, Christopher Kalanji, who was killed by police in 2016.
So he was 19. He just graduated a year and a half ago. And he was passionate about constitution rights. That's what he was know, like constitution very good. And I know always go help people if they have a problem with law. He loves history and it was his favorite, you know, subject at school. And he always come to discuss with his dad history. And, you know, he was like in it and always help his friends and can explain any what's going on in the country, like with his perspective view. And I was, you know, he was my heart because this boy, like, educate himself all the time. And I know when he grew up, he will be someone who can help people, you know, like defense people, help people, educate people. And his last year when his life, it was his like problem for him, it's police brutality, because he on October 22nd, 2015, he got stopped by police, and here in downtown Portland, just been on the wrong place, it was in the wrong time. And when they stop him and asking him his ID, and he says them that I don't do anything wrong, I just, you know, I just spending my time with friends here and doing nothing that you have to stop me and ask ID, and I have constitution rights to deny to do it. So the policeman get so mad about it, and they say, huh, you thinking you know everything? And he say, yes, I know my rights. And they grab him and arrest him.
And your son, like, there are pictures of him our radio listeners can't see, but, you know, he has a big afro. He has his profile because of that.
He has a hoodie this night, and he has big afro, and he never ashamed of this. He say, I am what I am, and you accept me like I am. Or I cannot be somebody who you want to be, you know. But he was so heart open and so helpful for people. He can stop by homeless people and help them. If he has a dollar or five in his pocket, he always gives them and stop to talk to them and know their problem. I know this after he's dead, because on candlelights, many homeless people come that I was surprised, and they talk about him. And they tell
vigil after he died?
Yeah, vigil after he died, many homeless people come. And I was so surprised because they tell, you know, I met this guy, he helped me this time. And he begged to me a couple of times and helped me with some pocket money. And he talked to me, and I know. So I was so surprised how my son was open heart and helped people in the community, you know. And I always know he will be something big one who can save lives. And before he die, that what he tell mom, we need educate people. You know, he will die, he feel it. He tell me they're coming to kill me because they don't like a truth that I tell them.
Thanks very much. I've been speaking with Irene Kalanji, the mother of Christopher Kalanji, who was murdered by a Clackamas County Sheriff on January 28th, 2016. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News outside of the Multnomah County Courthouse.
A new bill unveiled in the Oregon legislature would allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in the state. Several lawmakers are introducing a bill that would ask voters to amend the Oregon Constitution to lower the voting age from 18 to 16 years old. If the bill passes, the question would go to voters in the 2020 general election. It would make Oregon the first state in the nation to lower the voting age to 16. The bill is supported by the Bus Project, a nonprofit organization that encourages volunteer civic activism in Oregon. Since 2003, 13 other states have introduced bills to lower voting age, some just for school board elections and other for all state elections. As of yet, none have passed. Democratic State Senator Shamia Fagan introduced the measure on Monday. Several teenagers spoke in favor of the measure alongside Fagan on Monday at the Capitol in Salem. Speaking first is Senator Shamia Fagan, followed by students Christine Bynum of LaSalle High School and Natalie Khalil of Lake Oswego High School, and Oregon Youth for Gun Reform.
We believe that 16, 17-year-olds in Oregon should have a say in all of our elections. As we've seen in the national level, they're making decisions that affect their lives. It's not just school board and city council that's affecting our Oregon families and our Oregon 16 and 17-year-olds. So this bill is in the form of a constitutional referral to the Oregon ballot. Right now, the voting age is set at 18 in the Oregon Constitution. And so this would simply refer to the ballot the opportunity for voters in Oregon to enfranchise and lower the voting age to 16 in Oregon for all elections. There's kind of a national movement called Vote 16, and they have some incredible data showing that 16-year-olds are really in that sweet spot of having the maturity to make the decisions, but also the urgency being impacted by them. And in Oregon, in particular, our criminal justice laws affect 16-year-olds. Our driving laws affect 16-year-olds. 16-year-olds can work, as Christine mentioned, and pay taxes in Oregon. And so 16 is really that sweet spot where we believe, clearly, I don't have to say it, you all saw, that they have the intelligence and the wherewithal to make those decisions, to make informed decisions about who they would vote for. But also, they're at an age where they're actually impacted by the decisions that we all make.
16 makes sense because in 16-year-olds actually have to take civics classes in Oregon, so it would make sense that while you're learning simultaneously about the government that you participate in it. 16-year-olds also will make and create lifelong voters. It could be like a family situation where you have the entire family talking about it, talking about policies, and it's a great way to recommend lifelong voters while learning about your history of your government and not to repeat it and how you can be a part of it.
But for too long, people like me have had to speak for people 16 and over. So instead of hearing from me, you're going to hear from some of them. So first up, we have Christine Bynum.
Hello, my name is Christine Bynum. When I found out that I was 26 times more likely to be charged as an adult under a Measure 11 crime than the rest of my peers, I thought, this is crazy. Who would pass this? Last night, I posted a poll on my Instagram account asking whether 16-year-olds should have the opportunity to vote. And an unexpected 82% believe that high schoolers should at least have the opportunity. If I can be tried as an adult, why can't I vote like an adult? I pay income tax like an adult. I drive like an adult. I can be charged and sentenced as an adult. Why is something so important, such as voting, limited to those who are our present and not our future? Not a day goes by where politics aren't filling the hallways of my local high school. My high school even has a pro-choice club and a mandatory research paper on a controversial hot political topic. So my question is, why can't I drive like an adult, pay taxes like an adult, have an abortion like an adult, be charged and sentenced like an adult, but I can't vote like an adult? This is why our future, our vote, is so important. Why is it only politics I'm involved in is the high school buzz? Why is it my voice important enough until I turn 18? I am pleased to introduce some of my fellow advocates.
Okay, next we're going to hear from Natalie Khalil. Natalie?
Hey. Thank you guys. If you need my last name, it's K-H-A-L-I-L. I turned 18 like 3 days ago. I'm a student at Lake Oswego High School. I'm involved with Oregon Youth for Gun Reform and the BUS Project, and I'm at the Capitol today advocating for gun violence prevention. It seems as if in this country, we are more afraid to see young people with beer, a cigarette, a Juul, or a ballot in their hands than rather an assault weapon. According to theconversation.com, a black person living in an urban area is 500 times more likely to be killed in everyday gun violence than by terrorism. When I heard the tragic news of Jasmine Barnes's death, Jasmine Barnes was a 7-year-old girl who was killed outside of a Walmart in Houston, Texas. I was at that Walmart 3 hours before. I made a promise to her and myself that we will fix this epidemic in this country that allowed a 7-year-old's life to be stripped away from her. When given the opportunity, young people will remind our leaders that the NRA might be powerful, but nothing is more powerful than the youth of America. Change is on the rise, and young people deserve to form and voice their own opinions.
so we can address these disparities our generations are facing. We've waited too long for generations before us to take a stand, and now it's our turn. We're claiming our future, and we're asking lawmakers to give us our vote so we can do the same. We are the empowered youth. Thank you. Yes.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, Is It You or Is It Me? And at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with light showers and a low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 45 degrees. Today in history, in 1847, the Donner Party is rescued from the Sierra Nevada mountains after being stranded by the snow. And in 1942, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, resulting in the relocation and imprisonment of Japanese Americans during World War II. The quote of the day is from Coretta Scott King, who said, quote, "Hate is too great a burden to bear. It injures the hater more than it injures the hated."
Turkish law enforcement have launched raids to detain more than 300 people suspected of having links to Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen. The group is believed to be responsible for the coup attempt that occurred in 2016. The order to arrest 324 people was made by prosecutors as part of different probes into followers of Gulen, a U.S.-based cleric. Turkey is accusing Gulen of ordering the coup to topple President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in 2016. However, Gulen has repeatedly denied any involvement in the failed coup. Last week, more than 760 people were detained in military operations. Since 2016, tens of thousands of people have been arrested in Turkey over suspected links to Gulen. Additionally, more than 100,000 people have been fired or suspended from their jobs in the public sector. Despite criticism from allied nations and human rights organizations over the scale of the crackdown, law enforcement probes have continued at full force. In related news, a Portland trailblazer has been the latest to come under attack from the Turkish government. Turkey has named the basketball player Enes Kanter a terrorist because of his outspoken criticism of the Turkish government. When he was with the Knicks, Enes Kanter skipped a game against the Washington Wizards that played in London, fearing assassination by Turkish regime spies. Kanter has long been a critic of the regime of Turkish President Erdogan, calling him a lunatic, maniac dictator.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, a judge loosens pre-construction restrictions on the Keystone XL pipeline project, Minnesota tribes gather at the state capitol for Sovereignty Day, and a Reno event addresses missing and murdered Indigenous women.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Montana federal judge has loosened restrictions on pre-construction activities for the Keystone XL pipeline. The federal court halted the pipeline in November until the U.S. State Department completes an accurate and updated environmental impact study. TransCanada appealed the injunction to the Ninth Circuit and asked the Montana court to lift restrictions pending appeal. An environmental lawyer says once construction starts, opponents lose. Victoria Wicks has more.
At a hearing on January 14th, TransCanada asked federal judge Brian Morris to reconsider his injunction on all prep work that moves dirt. TransCanada says if the Ninth Circuit allows the company to go ahead with spring construction, some first steps need to happen now. In response, Morris has agreed to lift part of the injunction. When he first denied pre-construction, Morris cited bureaucratic momentum as one reason to halt work on a project that might ultimately be denied. Natalie Landreth is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund. She says bureaucratic momentum was a factor in the building of the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota.
Every time the tribal plaintiffs in that case would have a victory on some issue, immediately the pipeline company comes in and says, well, you can't stop construction because we've relied and we've invested this amount of money and therefore we have to keep going. That's what it creates when you allow the pipeline, the project to begin, you are allowing for them to build momentum, which they then use against you, even if you win on the ultimate issues.
In his most recent ruling, Judge Morris addresses momentum by allowing transportation of pipe and construction of pipe yards, but not worker camps. Morris says construction of camps that house, feed, and entertain 1,000 workers would disrupt a large area of land, resulting in, quote, a bureaucratic steamroller. Morris says TransCanada proceeds with the allowed activities at its own peril while the Ninth Circuit appeal progresses. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Leaders from Minnesota's 11 tribes gathered at the state capitol in St. Paul Monday for Sovereignty Day. Tribal issues and history were discussed with state lawmakers. Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan from the White Earth Nation was among speakers. Flanagan says Native communities are too often invisible to policymakers, adding the day was an important step in government-to-government relations. She affirmed the commitment from the governor's office to prioritize and consult with tribes, including in areas of education and missing and murdered Indigenous women. This was the first Sovereignty Day event at the Capitol. Native women recently rallied in Reno, Nevada, to draw attention to missing and murdered Indigenous women. Autumn Harry, a member of the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe, took part in the event. She's asking law enforcement at all levels to do a better job gathering and disseminating data in order to get a clearer picture of the problem.
There's not a national database to say how many missing and murdered Indigenous women there are, so there's not even an accurate count. In a lot of cases, they go unsolved.
Harry says she'd like to see more funding for tribal police forces and increased public awareness of the issue across the board.
I think a lot of it has to do with educating men as well, because this is a systemic issue of violence.
U.S. lawmakers recently reintroduced legislation to improve coordination between tribes and national law enforcement databases and break down jurisdictional barriers that have stymied investigations in the past. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thousands of visitors to a museum at the Grand Canyon over the last 19 years may have been exposed to radiation. On February 4th, OSHA certified safety and wellness manager Elston Stevenson sent an email to all Park Service employees at the Grand Canyon, exposing top management failures regarding improperly handled uranium. Stevenson informed his colleagues that radioactive uranium was discovered earlier in the year and suggested getting screened for possible exposure. The uranium was kept in a basement for decades until being moved into the newly opened Museum Collections Building in 2000, where exhibits, tours, and presentations are regularly held. In March 2018, a teenager with a Geiger counter discovered the material sitting in three buckets next to a taxidermy exhibit. He notified employees, who then moved the buckets to another building. A few months later, during a routine safety audit, Stevenson learned of the incident and asked for a radiation detection device from a national park in Colorado. When technicians arrived in June of last year, they were only armed with a broken mop handle and gardening gloves to take the buckets and dump them in a nearby potential Superfund site, the Orphan Mine. Stevenson also tells of trying to spur action from park superintendents, the FBI, members of Congress, and the inspector in general. He said that he was not taken seriously and noted management was more willing to dismiss his claims as a black employee and a whistleblower. He eventually decided to drive to Phoenix, Arizona to file a report with OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Agency. OSHA arrived in protective gear and traced low-level radiation to the empty buckets which had previously held the waste. OSHA is now working with the Arizona Department of Health Services in an ongoing investigation.
On February 14th, an editor and publisher for the Democratic Reporter in Linden, Alabama, wrote an editorial titled, "The Klan Needs to Ride Again." Editor Goodloe Sutton wrote, quote, "Time for the Ku Klux Klan to ride again. Democrats in the Republican Party and Democrats are plotting to raise taxes in Alabama." After the outrageous editorial, Alabama Senator Doug Jones and Representative Terry Sewell called for Sutton to step down from his position at the local newspaper, which has a current reach of around 3,000 people.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 19, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kabanoglu, Emily Gresham Beamer, Al Khan, Leslie McClam, and Alex Riedlinger. The producer is Yasmin Kobenglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath, on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Alex Riedlinger.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland digs into gentrification with the City Council vote on the Central Eastside Industrial Council's proposed Enhanced Services District. At 9, the radio activist talks about activism and what happens next. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Food Sleuth Radio, dietitian Melinda Hemmelgarn helps listeners think beyond their plates, connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture, and find food truth. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a special segment that airs every week at 5:30 on Tuesdays. It's called Totality of Circumstances. I'm Sam Bowman.
Jasmine Moneymaker.
And happy birthday, Jasmine, by the way. We'll get that
great.
Out of the
Thanks.
Way.
Thanks. Call me out.
Headline number one. So this week we're going to talk about primarily about the PPB's ongoing rollout of its body cam proposal. This is the second time in my living memory that they've tried to do this. They had a attempt going from 2014 to 15 that didn't go so hot, but we'll get into that in a little bit, and there'll be more on the show, but we wanted to try to take a look at some news stories that have been happening over the past week that we have not had time to expand on this show, but we wanted to make sure that everyone knew about them.
Well, I mean, it's been a huge week.
Huge.
Starting with the day after last Tuesday, Portland City Council voted us all out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which was a huge win for activists in the city who have been trying for years to make the community feel safer for people. I mean, the bulk of the testimony that went on for hours, there were some like 36 people who testified, and I watched all of it, and by my count, there were only two people who voted to remain in the Joint Terrorism, or not voted, but who recommended that Portland remain in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Worth mentioning, they were both white males. But it was just, it was hours of testimony of people talking about their real lived experience with being victimized by the FBI. And it's hard for me to it's hard for me to see how Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Fish like followed that up with the idea that somehow we could, you know, if we stayed in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, we could play nice with the FBI. Like it's better to be with them than against them. But in the end, the decision was made to leave, and that is that would have been the biggest news of last week if not for the joint reporting. Well, I don't know if it was actually joint reporting, but the reports that came out of Willamette Week and the Portland Mercury by Katie Shepard and Alex Zelensky about the text messages, the Jeffrey Nia text messages.
Yeah. Yeah, so in case you missed it, which if you're listening to this show that airs after the KBOO News, you probably did not miss it. Jeff Nia was the lieutenant in charge of the rapid response team, which is the, you know, the vests and armor that you see at the big protest events that have been happening in Portland over the past 2 years. And before that, the riot cops, you know. He was found to be texting in a very friendly manner with Joey Gibson, the leader of Patriot Prayer, who has brought the brawlers to the city pretty much for the last 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, the texts are pretty sticky his role is, Jeffrey Nia's role is to communicate with protest leaders and protest participants. I mean, we've heard his name come up again and again at city council sessions and in other reporting over the years. But, I mean, I think a lot of people felt like this just really crossed the line, especially because he seemed to be protecting Tiny, who is a street brawler, essentially. And
it was a Tusitala Toese.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we should point out, they seem to cross the line for us and for most people who seem to be paying attention to this story, but it points to general practices by police officers who are getting ready to respond to protests like this. I mean, just today, the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association announced that it was filing a formal complaint against the city for having Nia removed from his duty as lieutenant of the rapid response team. And that's, you know, because they feel that the way the city has been talking about him in the wake of this is derogatory and detrimental to his career. And, I mean, the unspoken part of that is that this is how police communicate with
This is how police communicate with everybody, you know, and that's the thing is, like, there's we have an interview coming up later on the show with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch, and at the end of the interview he makes a comment, you know, about the idea of community policing and what that means to the police as opposed to the people in the community. And, you know, essentially the idea is that this is how the police operate. They operate, they form relationships with people not in an effort to make them safer necessarily, although that is a reason that they put forward and that might sometimes be the case. But the ultimate consequence of the, you know, that sort of power imbalance is that what they're really doing is essentially surveilling people, even when what they're doing is they're having these text message conversations, they're forming these relationships with people. The ultimate goal is to police them more effectively. And the disconnect between that and what the community expects of the police is pretty interesting.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot I was on the radio for a minute. I was just nodding along there. So what else happened this week? You were saying...
Katie Shepard had like a double whammy. So she did she got the Jeffrey Nia text, and then she got something that has kind of, like, I've seen it in a few places, but I feel like it should really be a much bigger story. I mean, she basically found out that the Multnomah County prosecutors, the DA's office, have been, I don't know, falsifying might be a strong word, but I think that's essentially what happened, been happening, falsifying their grand jury results. So basically what happens is if the prosecutors take a case to the grand jury and the grand jury declines to issue an indictment, it's called a no bill. And when that happens, the prosecutor's office is supposed to formally log that no bill in the system, because then they need a court order to reinitiate another grand jury. And the prosecutor's office just basically wasn't doing that. They were logging it as no decision instead. So they were essentially violating the constitutional rights of Portlanders for decades. And that's kind of a big story.
Yeah. Right? And even in Willamette Week, it was, four or five paragraphs. And I'm curious to see what comes out of this. And on that note, we probably should move on. And for the sake of this show.
Sorry, everybody.
No, that's there's a lot to chew on there. And hopefully there's more details for next week, I guess. Yeah. What was it? Saturday morning, I went to the first town hall that the police bureau held for its new proposed body cam program, body-worn cameras, as they call them. There's three of them scheduled, and this is, aside from the online form, this is how the bureau is getting feedback from people in the community. And they are, they said multiple times, like, we don't know how this is going to be, for example, with body cameras in schools, body cameras in hospitals, when they're going to be turned off. We don't know. The law doesn't tell us what we need to do in certain situations, and that's why we're asking you, the people in this room. And as it turned out, there were about 23 people in there, and I would say that myself and two others were media, at least OPB and the East Portland News were there. I apologize to the East Portland News if I'm getting that wrong, but they have a pretty solid website. They do like 4,000 stories over the last 10 years or something, all about East Portland. There were about 10 bureau employees there and two facilitators, which leaves about, I think, 8 or 9
members of the general public.
Actual members of the general public.
That's not a bad turnout for a PPB event, to be honest.
It's not. It's less than 50%, but it's. But so to give you an idea of what sort of community feedback was being gotten from this, so I sat at the first table. I sat at was me, the OPB reporter, the bureau facilitator, a police officer named Natasha Hounsberger, and then two community members, so two out of the six people at the table. And this is, the two community members were members of the Lentz Neighborhood Livability Organization, and this should give you a little bit of an idea about what sort of feedback the Bureau is getting. This is starts with Officer Hounsberger asking them what to do in the event of, recording Miranda rights.
If an officer is placing someone under arrest and recording the advisement of Miranda rights, do you think that should be recorded for both officers?
I would
and the
record
person?
It.
Oh yeah.
I would record it because they're going to get down there and they're going to say that never was. I never heard that. I would record it for your sake.
Okay.
Yeah, as a policy matter, I think it would be very good for the police to record that.
I mean, I don't know what you deal with on a daily basis, but just walking down our street.
We know what we encounter. Which brings up another point, which I think would be good. It would be good for the public, I guess, because there are many people that do not trust the police, and I really think that so much of what the police do is not police work, but mental health evaluation or just coming into contact with someone who's in a mental health crisis. I really think those incidents need to be recorded because they can turn bad so quickly that there isn't time to activate a camera when the guy pulls out a knife or
hatchet.
Or a hatchet.
So this sounds like if you're saying, like, you're responding on an ECIT call, that you would be recording, or if you're responding where there's a suspected component of mental health.
Right.
Okay.
So it sounds like that was a big part of the concern there was specifically like how officers will respond to mental health calls and how what the body cams will do in that case. And was there any resolution on that, or was there any?
Well, there was very little resolution from this event in general. And to be fair, that's not what they were looking for. They just wanted feedback on certain things. But there was a fair amount of mention of mental health situations. In fact, kind of playing off of that, the Ella Fritz shooting back in April of last year, the one that happened at the City Team Ministries shelter on Southeast Grand, that came up briefly in the context of cell phone footage of the event, which doesn't really answer your question about mental health, because that didn't quite address that. But, you know, just the way that, I should say, in general, the comments that they seem to have received and taken to heart really are the ones that support officers having the footage for their own protection.
Right.
And there was some lip service paid to, you know, the community having access to some, but mostly it was about the ins and outs of an officer's interaction with body cams.
I mean, where would you say that was coming from? Because, I mean, you mentioned that this isn't the first time that the Portland Police Bureau has been down this road, and there was a set of, you know, sort of draft directives that was released in 2015 when this project happened before. And sort of like the, out of privacy considerations, you know, there's an Oregon law in place that lays out quite a few things about specific to body cams. One of the gray areas in that law is the privacy considerations, especially related to mental health. So, like, where would you say that those concerns were coming from? Is that from the public, or is that from the PPB in terms of officers having access to the footage?
Well, in this town hall, I'd say it was both. I mean, and one thing I would say is it definitely feels like a restart from zero, mm-hmm. compared to the 2014-15 effort, because that largely petered out after the negotiations with the police union over this issue of officers being allowed to view footage from the cameras before writing their report on the incident that is depicted on the cameras.
Right.
And this time around, so what happens is we sit at tables in small groups at these things, and there's a specific topic for each table. And the table I was at, the first table that you just heard some audio from, after that, they went around to every table like, "What'd you learn?" And one of the tables, the next one that I went to, what they said in this, after the first table, sorry, what they said was, one thing we're hearing is, like, there's not a lot of problems with officers being allowed to view footage, in so many words.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to I don't really need to explain that myself, because I have a recording. The next table that I sat at was me, two police officers, one of them was a sergeant, a Bureau civilian employee, and one of the facilitators. So there were no just flat-out community members at this table at all, which was awkward for me because I am a volunteer but also a reporter. I also work in, like, a social services setting, so I have my own questions about, you know, where officers are allowed to turn their cameras on and stuff. But anyway, I asked the sergeant, and his name is Mark Friedman. He's with the Gun Violence Reduction Task Force, and there was also Officer Carlos Ibarra, who's a school resource officer there. I asked them about why cops should be allowed to view footage before the report, and this was Friedman's answer to that.
It's kind of I'm simplifying it a little bit, but I guess generally speaking, you know, the video is the video, right?
Yeah.
The officer still has to justify and articulate their whatever actions they may or may not have taken, given the circumstances. I don't think that for the office, a lot of officers, their perspective is, if I'm permitted to view the video and I can articulate all of that in my report, that benefits everybody. It's not a space in the word. It's not. It's not a. My intent is not evil, because I didn't.
There's no malintent.
Right, because I was permitted to view the video and document it accurately the first time around.
So that, I mean, that comment about, you know, it not being a something surreptitious, I think is the word he was looking for, in them reviewing the footage, it really kind of misses the point that what we're looking for in officer reporting is an accurate representation of their actual thoughts at the time. And there are significant legal reasons why that's what we want to hear. And so I understand that they wouldn't necessarily think there was any malintent, but that's still, you know, kind of a challenge when it comes to whether or not, like, what we're hearing is their actual recollection or something supported by video evidence. But anyway, I mean, it'll be interesting to hear at the next meeting, which is, I think, coming up on, is it Friday? The 22nd from 2:30 to 4:30 at the Matt Dishman Community Center.
Exactly. That's in Northeast Portland, I believe. Yeah.
If anybody wants to show up for that and have an opportunity to get more feedback and...
Yeah, we'll be there. Say hi.
Yeah, come say hi to us. All right, so now for the last story of tonight, we are going to enter into the realm of the acronyms that we all know and loathe. And so 2 weeks ago, we reported on the presentation of a draft report at the PSEP meeting. And PSEP is, of course, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing.
So PCSEP. I guess it's an accurate name.
And this report is a part of the requirements of the U.S. DOJ settlement agreement, which we've talked about many times and are going to try to avoid explaining anew each time we mention it, but it's going to come up again and again. So the deadline for public comment on this most recent draft report was the 15th, and the final report is due to be released on the 28th. As always, Portland Cop Watch composed a detailed and thorough analysis of the report, and I talked to Dan Handelman by phone earlier today about the group's main takeaways. All right, so this report covered sections 8 and 9 of the settlement agreement dealing with officer accountability and community engagement and the creation of the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. From your comments, some of the biggest takeaways for you had to deal with their interpretation of traffic stop data. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in the community engagement section, originally the board that the PCCEP replaced was supposed to help design what kind of data was going to be collected around traffic stops, but that got jettisoned when they revised the settlement agreement to create the PCCEP. Right now, the Bureau just has to share these data with the new board, but they haven't done so yet. What we found is that rather than dive into the numbers themselves or ask serious questions about it, the compliance officer kind of praised the Police Bureau for making this what they're calling a very thorough, sophisticated, and transparent analysis, but which really was what we call statistical gymnastics, trying to deny the fact that Portland police racially profile.
There are significant disparities in the number of African-American Portlanders who are stopped compared to their representation in the census, but they explain that that doesn't indicate biased policing because of their crime victimization benchmark. Can you explain that?
Well, I can't explain it from a logical point of view, but their thought is that even though Portland's 6% black and 13% of people that are pulled over are African American in the city, that we shouldn't be concerned because the crash data show that 9% of adult drivers who have, or people of driving age who have accidents, are African American. But then the stop rate should be 9% and not 13%, which is what it is. So they're already not making sense there. And then they jump to looking at the gang enforcement team, which is buried in the back of the Bureau's analysis that the COCL is reporting on. And the gang enforcement team has a stop rate of 61% of African Americans in a city that's 6% black. And instead of being alarmed by this or worrying about it, the Bureau says, oh, well, but 71% of victims of gang crime are black. Therefore, we're actually understopping that population. And the COCL doesn't take them to task for doing this or question it or do his own analysis. He just says, wow, this is great. You know, look at all these number crunchings that they did.
It just seems to me that regardless of whether or not those are effective benchmarks, what the data show is still that black people are being over-policed in Portland.
Correct. And they even, when you get down to it, you know, a lot of times, and this argument wasn't really made in either report, but a lot of times when we accuse them of bias-based policing, they say, well, when we're driving along at night, we can't really see what color the driver is, so, you know, you can't say that's racially biased. But then when you look at who's getting searched, African-Americans are searched at above the rate of white people, and they're found not to have contraband at any higher rate than anybody else. In fact, I don't remember if I did crunch numbers on this particular report, but generally speaking, we find that only about 80% as much contraband is found on African Americans because they're being over-searched, so therefore the quote-unquote hit rate, what they call it, when they find contraband, is lower. So that's an example of over-policing. The gang enforcement team, the COCL notes, searches African Americans. Well, they use what they call consent searches, which is like, do you mind if I search you? Which when there's a police officer with a gun and a badge and pepper spray and a taser staring at you, a lot of people aren't going to refuse that, even though it's their right to, if they don't have probable cause. And they overuse those, and then they find less contraband as a result. Just the gang enforcement team, but I think that's generally true for other traffic stops as well.
What you're sort of describing is just an overall lack of analysis being done by the COCL. They're just taking the data from the PPB, looking at it without auditing the data or trying to collect their own data. And for a group that's supposed to be independent, it really just sort of seems like they're not doing the job that the community expects them to do. And it seems like that's a consistent theme in their reports.
And our feedback on the reports. And, you know, we constantly make little digs at the COCL for not being from Portland. But, you know, it sounds kind of minor, but it's actually really important. I think that if there was a compliance officer that lived here, they'd have a better perspective on all this means. And, you know, for example, the number of pedestrian stops has plummeted by almost 90%, and they don't question why that might be. And they say, oh, it's probably part, well, they say they think it's because of the concerns nationwide about, you know, people being over-policed in the wake of Ferguson. But I think that it's more that police in Portland aren't reporting what you and I would consider to be a stop anymore. And so that's why the numbers are down. They're actually still stopping people. I mean, we hear about people being harassed and even witness it from, you know, pretty regularly. But they have the number of pedestrian stops is only about 25 people per quarter, which is, oh no, it's per month, 25 people per month. You know, so you're saying that there's 800 police officers out on patrol in a city of 600,000 people plus, and they only stop 25 people a month? I don't believe that at all.
And we don't have any evidence that the COCL has been looking into that, that they asked that question or pursued an answer.
That is true. I really like to see somebody dig in and find out what's going on. There was a captain named Larry Graham, who we had a lot of disagreements with. He's the person who pulled the permit on May Day 2017 when all hell broke loose because of the police riot. But he was on a board that was called the Community Police Relations Committee, and he was saying that in addition to stops, we should also be collecting data on mere conversations, which is the kind of discussions that we were talking about before. And then that board fell apart, and then there was nobody left in the Bureau saying, well, we should really find a way to track those. But that's a very important thing for the community to be asking for, that the police should track mere conversations, and then we can see whether they're over-policing certain segments of the community.
As far as the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing goes, the PCEP, they got high marks from the Rosenbaum group in this report. But as you point out, it's really kind of too early to tell exactly what's going to happen with them. All right, so that, unfortunately, we're not going to have time to air the rest of that interview right now. We will put it up online for y'all to listen to. But that was Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch talking about the group's recent feedback of the COCL report. So we're going to dive right in the last couple minutes to the calendar updates. Tomorrow, the CRC has a work group in room 110 at City Hall from 5:30 to 6:30. That is on their crowd control policies. And then the PPB is hosting a listening session for the Jeffrey Nia Patriot Prayer Text on Thursday from 6 to 8 at the Marantha Church on 12th and Skidmore. And then, as we already mentioned, the next PPB Body Cam Forum is February 22nd from 2:30 to 4:30 at Matt Dishman Community Center. And finally, the PCEP, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, is holding their monthly meeting at 5:30 on Tuesday. That's next Tuesday at Tabor Space.
And what was I going to say? Oh, next week, tune in at 5:30 to Totality of Circumstances. We're going to have the Portland State University Student Union, SUSU, on the show to talk about issues that they're engaged with. Good night, Jasmine.
Good night, Sam.
And good night, Liam. Thank you so
much. Thanks, Liam.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth